Here's Brady speaking with 710 AM in Seattle earlier today.
I don't understand it. If he's not a first ballot Hall of Famer, there's really no coach that should ever be a first ballot Hall of Famer, which is completely ridiculous because people deserve it, and he's incredible.
Brady saying that there is no coach he would rather play for than Belichick. The Cleveland Browns are hiring former Ravens offensive coordinator Todd Monken to be their new head coach. Now, Browns defensive coordinator Jim Schwartz reportedly does not want to return in the same position after he was one of the three finalists for the head coaching job. And ESPN reports his multiple teams have made aggressive offers for Milwaukee Bucks forward Giannis Antetokounmpo. The report says Giannis has told the team for months that he wants to be traded, and the team is now listening to those offers. Patrick Reed announced he is leaving LIV Golf and will eventually return to the PGA Tour.
Fox Sports Update on KPRL, brought to you by Deeds Bar and Grill at the Paso Robles Golf Club. Great food, great view, great people. Prime Rib Monday, Taco Tuesday, Wine Down Wednesday, and specials Thursday through Saturday. Today in Farming on KPRL is brought to you by Paso Robles Glass, established in 1947, always up on the latest technology and training. They do windows right. Call Paso Robles Glass, 805-238-4014.
From the Ag Information Network, I'm Bob Larson with your agribusiness update. Well, the Center for the Environment and Welfare released an analysis of a letter widely promoted by animal rights operatives, allegedly signed by 5,000 farmers and producers who support California's Proposition 12. The analysis shows many of the backers are not pork or egg producers, with some not even involved in agriculture. The list includes many vineyards, honey producers, mushroom growers, hemp and marijuana farms, and even a goat yoga operator. Well, it appears the House funding bill will not include language allowing year-round access to E15 nationwide. Instead, Congress appears poised to create a new Rural Domestic Energy Council that would develop potential legislative proposals on E15 and other renewable fuels. Renewable Fuels Association President Jeff Cooper says, "We are extremely disappointed that Congress appears to have again failed in adopting a simple fix that would make cleaner, low-cost American-made E15 available all year long." Well, the USDA is awarding more than $11 million in grant funding to support dairy businesses and producers through the Dairy Business Innovation Grant Program. The initiative supports small and mid-sized dairy businesses in the development, production, marketing, and distribution of dairy products. USDA Undersecretary Dudley Hoskins says this funding makes important investments in the domestic dairy industry, furthering USDA's effort to ensure Americans have access to affordable, wholesome dairy products.
Today, we're talking with aphids and whiteflies about Safina insecticide from BASF.
We just got nailed with it.
So tell us, how you feeling?
Really, really weird.
And you still want to devour this field?
No way, bro.
There you have it, folks. Safina insecticide is specifically engineered to disorient aphids and whiteflies so they can't eat. And when they can't eat, they can't destroy.
Help protect your alfalfa from aphids with Safina insecticide. Always read and follow label directions.
Increasing your almond yield can seem like a tough nut to crack, but it doesn't have to be. Protect your crop with Marivon fungicide at Bloom for added resiliency against frost, long-lasting broad-spectrum disease control, and proven yield results. See? That wasn't tough at all. Marivon fungicide, number one at Bloom for all the right reasons. Always read and follow label directions.
From the Ag Information Network, I'm Bob Larson with your agribusiness update.
Today in Farming on KPRL is brought to you by Paso Robles Glass, established in 1947, always up on the latest technology and training. They do windows right. Call Paso Robles Glass, 805-238-4014.
This Fox Business News update on KPRL is brought to you by Stifel, your full-service wealth management firm since 1890. Stifel, located at 1337 Vine Street in Paso Robles. Call 805-238-3080. Stifel, 238-3080.
I'm Stuart Varney, and this is the Fox Business Report.
Stocks are mixed in afternoon trading. As expected, the Fed is leaving its benchmark interest rate unchanged at a rate of 3.5% to 3.75% after three cuts last year. Two Fed governors, Stephen Miron and Christopher Waller, dissented from the decision to hold rates steady for the first time since July. Both prefer to see rates lowered by a quarter percentage point. President Trump appointed Miron in September, while Waller's under consideration by the White House to replace Chair Jerome Powell, whose term ends in May. Shares of Seagate Technology are up over 18% after delivering robust financial results, with its revenue increasing 22% year over year, and its guidance was way above analyst expectations. The artificial intelligence boom is driving increased demand for memory chips and hard drives, benefiting Seagate and other companies. That's your Fox Business Report. I'm Hillary Barsky, invested in you.
I'm alpine skier Michaela Schifrin. I've won the most World Cup ski races in history. But what does success mean to me? Success means discipline. It's teamwork. It's the drive and passion inside of us. And it's why Stifel is one of the fastest growing global wealth management firms in the country. If you're looking for success, surround yourself with the people who will get you there. If you're an advisor or investor, choose Stifel, where success meets success.
Stifel Nicolaus & Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
Past performance is no indication of future results. Investing involves risk. Consult a financial advisor before making any investment decision.
This Fox Business News update on KPRL brought to you by Stifel, your full-service wealth management firm since 1890. Stifel, located at 1337 Vine Street in Paso Robles. Call 805-238-3080. Stifel, 238-3080.
American Legends, next on KPRL. Brought to you by Davis Body Shop.
If you're not familiar with the term boondoggle, consider the fact our federal government recently underwrote the total cost of a study dealing with Polish bisexual frogs. If that doesn't give you a hint, stand by. I'll be right back.
Reagan, in his own voice, is brought to you by K-Brush Concrete, serving the entire Central Coast for more than a decade. Call Kevin at K-Brush Concrete, 423-4033.
A while back, the federal government handed out a grant to some researchers to produce a study called The Demography of Happiness. They surveyed quite a few people to find out why some lead happier lives than others. They found, as a rule, that younger people were happier than older people, people with money were happier than those without it, and healthy people were happier than those who were sick. The cost for all of this was $249,000. $249,000 to find out that it's better to be young, rich, and healthy than old, sick, and poor. I mention this case to remind you that although the economy is sluggish, the federal boondoggle business is booming. A few years ago, a magazine receiving funds from the National Foundation on the Arts published a one-word poem for which it paid the author $500. The word was light, spelled with two extra consonants. Now, that would be hilarious if it weren't for the fact that some Americans go to bed hungry or without jobs, while the federal arbiters of taste hand out frivolous gifts from the public purse. The Food and Drug Administration paid a Buffalo, New York company to conduct a study of why children fall off tricycles. The research engineers drew a profound conclusion. They fall off tricycles because they lose their balance or collide with an object. They also learned that children get longer legs as they get older, thus complicating the business of riding tricycles. Now, the purpose behind this survey was to help the FDA determine if it should issue safety design standards for tricycles. I'm not at all sure the government has any business considering such things, unless someone has proved that a lot of kids are injured riding tricycles, thus constituting a national problem. And no word of such a problem preceded the study. The Smithsonian Institution, which is federally funded, of course, isn't averse to putting in for some exotic boondoggles, too. Not long ago, it sent Congress a shopping list of research projects it wanted to sponsor, including reproductive rhythms of catfish in India, or how fishing boat crews cause conflicts in Yugoslavian peasant towns, and a study of Polish bisexual frogs. Now, some of these studies may serve a larger, more serious purpose, but one can only wonder why private sources and colleges and universities aren't taking these projects on for themselves. The frog study, for example, was intended to test some new methods for distinguishing between one species of animal and another. Now, that may be a legitimate scientific research objective, but is that what we have a federal government for? In recent years, a new cottage industry has sprung up to take advantage of federal boondoggles in the name of science and culture. A small army of bright wordsmiths and scholars will, for a fee, help prospective grantees dream up serious-sounding titles for their projects in order to impress Congress or a federal agency. Grant proposals are chock full of persuasive salesmanship, stressing the vital nature of the grantee's project. That Congress takes such stuff seriously at all is a measure of how far we've strayed in recent years from the original purposes of federal government. There are a few congressmen who battle the boondoggles, who say, in effect, hey, wait a minute. What business does government have paying for this? What's the benefit to the taxpayers? What we need is a research program that'll tell us how we can get a few hundred more congressmen just like those others. This is Ronald Reagan. Thanks for listening.
Reagan, in his own voice, brought to you by K-Brush Concrete. Anything to do with concrete, from a 5x5 walkway to a 500,000-square-foot foundation. Call Kevin at K-Brush Concrete, 423-4033.
Welcome to Sound Off. My name is Karen Veeley. I'm your host on Wednesday and Thursday afternoons. I'm also an investigative reporter with Cal Coast News. Go to Cal Coast News. There is no paywall. And today I have San Luis Obispo County Sheriff's, what I've called him is, he is the most impressive cold case detective I think this county has ever had. And he does have a team that works with him. And he has done a terrific job of bringing out issues in the county, solving cold cases. And I'm hoping that everyone can hear me. Clint, I want to introduce you. Thank you for coming on the show.
Well, thank you very much, Karen. It's very kind of you. I'm happy to be here.
And so the latest... the latest cold case, you had told us about it before. Can you explain a little bit about the latest cold case that you have, again, solved? And what I want people to realize, this is probably the fourth or fifth that you've solved since you've been in. Many times counties have a case that goes back to the 80s or the 90s, and they just let it go. They don't try to solve it. They don't work to give closure. And they brought Clint Cole in. And what I believe is that you have a knack for this. There are people that have, that they're good at something, and they're very good, and they just do it differently than others. And you've had a tremendous job going back. The Kristen Smart is the most well-known. But this case is also very, very important. Can you tell us a little bit about the case?
Yeah, well, once again, thank you for the kind words. I don't know that I do anything special other than I'm persistent. You know, I try not to give up on these cases. I do feel the strong need for these cases to be solved for their families' sakes. And this case was proof of that when Toby Tate's sister came out. It was so rewarding to have her out. I'll start before we go into that. I'll go ahead and just kind of discuss the case briefly. And it was November 15th, 1983, at about 10 o'clock in the morning, when deputies got a phone call of a suspicious circumstances regarding a van, which was parked at an overlook in San Simeon, north, about 2.7 miles north of the Hearst Castle. It was a white van that, I forget what you call them, but it was one of those camping-style vans where you camp in them. It had a little mini fridge, mini stove, and 1980s version. And deputies arrived. They saw a pool of blood flowing on the side of the van, the big, large sliding door on the van, on the passenger side. Kind of underneath that door, there was a pool of blood that was dripping off onto the ground. And so when they looked inside of the two broken windows, both the driver's side and passenger side front door windows had been broken out. They saw the lifeless dead body of a female later identified as Dorothy Toby Tate, laying in the back of the van with a gunshot wound to the side of her head. Early investigation, really, there was no suspects. This was a fairly remote area in 1983. Highway 1 wasn't near as busy as it is now. And so they collected some evidence, and, you know, we're so thankful that they collected the evidence they did. If it wasn't for previous investigators collecting the evidence properly and us, you know, securing it and storing it properly, you know, these cases aren't as easily solved. And so one of the most important pieces of evidence they located was, it appeared Dorothy was most likely trying to get away from these guys. It was a robbery, burglary motive. There was no sign of sexual assault of any kind. We learned from Dorothy Toby's sister, Priscilla, that Dorothy had been running on the beach with her dogs that morning. And there was a phone call between Toby and Priscilla the night before, where Toby, who camped nearby at the still San Simeon State Campground, she had told her sister, "Hey, I'm going to go for a run. I found this place. I'm going to go for a run on the beach." That was like this big highlight. So Toby was on the beach running, and at some point she runs into these bad guys who rob her, or attempting to rob her, and it appears she's trying to get away because she's shot in the driver's side through the window in the side of the head with a .45 caliber handgun, which is a pretty powerful weapon. And she rolls slightly forward and bumps into the suspect truck, causing some damage to the left side of the truck and the right side of Dorothy's van. And then she veers off of that to the left a little bit, where she's now facing Highway 1. So at probably after that is when the suspects went in and robbed her and stole all her belongings. They also, you could easily see Toby sitting in the front seat of her car from Highway 1. So they moved her from the front seat and drug her back into the camping area of the van, and just laid her in the floor there.
So people driving by in the could see this?
Yes.
Did anyone see the scuffle inside when it happened?
No, there was never anybody, no mention of anybody. Like I said, you know, 1983, Highway 1 wasn't near as busy as it is now, especially that far north. You know, we're talking north of San Simeon. And so one of the suspects, who we later identified through genealogy with C.C. Moore and Parabon Nanolabs, is Stephen Hardy. And what happened is somehow Hardy got cut and was dropping blood from Toby's van to where the suspect's truck was. And I believe Tony Coppola had released some of these photos to the media. And you can see the markers, those were blood trails, and they collected that blood. And we preserved it well enough. It was slightly degraded, but it was still enough that we got it processed, uploaded it into CODIS. We knew it really couldn't have been Toby's blood because she was shot in the vehicle and stayed in the vehicle dead. So it was easy to assume that it was most likely suspect's blood.
But at that time, you really could not track them completely by the blood?
Excuse me, no.
But could you rule somebody out because they didn't match it?
So what they collected blood for back before DNA was usually like blood typing. So if, let's say we have two suspects, and the suspect blood on the scene, on the floor, on the ground is type B. And we have one suspect who's type B and one suspect that we are concerned about is type O. You can rule the type O guy out. So that was good at the time, but nothing like what we have DNA now, where you can rule a suspect in 1 in 250 quintillion. And so that's why they were collecting the blood back then. And, you know, we thank heavens they did, because we did a upload into the CODIS data bank. There were no matches. Stephen Hardy had never been arrested for felonies. He died in 2003 from natural causes in a veterans hospital in Phoenix. So he was really, he had died really before mandatory testing was taking off for criminals, but he didn't have any felony arrests, so he wouldn't have qualified for mandatory testing anyhow. All of his arrests were misdemeanors, like urinating in public. He lived kind of a transient life. And so we did a familial search where we're looking for a close family member. Got no matches, so then the next step is genealogy. And so this case, when I retired briefly, a detective worked on this case a little bit. He didn't identify Hardy or Sneed. So when I came back to work, we began continuing working on this case. And through C.C. Moore, we were able to identify Stephen Hardy. And interestingly enough, I just got off the phone with his sister before walking in here. And
Hardy's sister?
Hardy's sister. So it was her DNA that we collected to confirm it being Hardy's blood. So the genealogists, through their trees, will say, we believe a high percentage that your guy who deposited that blood on the scene is Stephen Hardy. Here's his other family members. So we contacted his sister, and she was very cooperative, very supportive of law enforcement, was very honest with her, told her that her brother may be involved in a homicide. She doubted it that he would be, which most people probably wouldn't think, yeah, my brother's involved in a homicide. But she was cooperative. She gave us her DNA. We sent it to the lab. Back to C.C. Moore. And overnight, she said, yep, yeah, it's him. And so that's how we identified Stephen Hardy. I don't believe Stephen Hardy was the shooter. His criminal history was really minor. He had mental health issues from serving in Vietnam. And, you know, as we know now, a lot of soldiers who came back from Vietnam weren't properly taken care of as well as probably they should have been. And so he just kind of drifted around, you know, drank his beer and was transient type person. He did have roots in Ventura, California, which is why we think they ended up here. In regards to Charlie Sneed, he was the much more violent individual. Just prior to coming out to California with Hardy, he had got into a disagreement with a relative of his, and he thought this female had said some things to Sneed's wife to interfere with their marriage. So he got angry enough over that he shot up her car. So after getting released initially from that case, we believe that's when they came to California.
Were they known to run together before this?
Yes. So Detective Rob Ashotti, my partner, who did most of the work on Sneed and Tate, because I was busy doing some stuff in the Smart case, interviewed a cop from New Braunfels, Texas, who's still alive, knew them, had arrested them both back in the day, 80s, and said, if you saw one, you usually saw the other together. So we knew they ran together, but we knew it was Hardy's blood. There was really no other DNA evidence at the scene, but Detective Rob Asciotti had noted this Coke can, which was about 30 feet from Dorothy's van, kind of off the bluff going down towards the beach.
So law enforcement picked up the Coke can, kept it for evidence, and then what did you do with the Coke can?
So what we did with the Coke can is we gave it to our outstanding crime lab technician, Shelby Liddell, who is excellent at doing fingerprint work. And in a very short time, we gave her a name of another guy we thought could be involved. And she right away said, no, it's not your guy, but you need to look at this guy named Charlie Sneed. So Shelby did an excellent job of identifying Sneed. And, you know, fingerprint evidence is pretty much just as reliable as DNA. And in some cases, some old-time investigators would probably rather have fingerprints than DNA because no one has the same as just like DNA. DNA, twins have the same DNA. So fingerprints can always be even a little more reliable in some instances than DNA. And so Shelby identified him. We went to work on Sneed. After our homicide, they go back to New Braunfels, Texas, where Sneed then confronts the lady whose car he shot up's husband, and kidnaps him and actually fires a round off in his direction to scare him during this aggravated kidnapping. Well, Sneed got 40 years in prison for that.
Did he die in prison?
No, he did not. So he paroled in 2009 and died of natural causes in 2012. And so after the homicide, there doesn't appear to be a whole lot of contact between them because Sneed's in prison. And then Hardy had died before Sneed got out of prison. But they definitely were partners and ran together prior to Sneed going to prison. And so with Shelby Liddell's identification of Sneed and C.C. Moore's identification of Hardy, we put the case together. We did as much background on both suspects as we can. And we submit the case to the district attorney's office. And Assistant District Attorney Eric Dobroth reviews all homicide cases in our county. And even though this is an old 83 case with deceased suspects, we treat it like they're alive. And so we need to clear the case through the Department of Justice, who keeps tracks of all these homicides. And so we want to be able to officially clear this case through the Department of Justice. And so that's why we have the DA review it. They give us a letter saying that the case could be prosecuted if the subjects were still alive. There was a little clause in it that since the felony murder rule in California has changed, it would be a little more difficult to prosecute the non-shooter, potentially, but just because the felony murder rule has changed in the last couple of years, that's just legal mumbo-jumbo that really doesn't get in the way of this case, especially when they're both deceased. And so the DA's office gave us approval letter, and so now I haven't done it yet because things have been kind of crazy since the case solved. But I'm going to write a report, and we will forward that to the Department of Justice, and they will eventually clear the case out as a solved homicide, and it'll be taken off of our books and their books. And that's the process that we go through so that we can officially clear them as solved homicides.
Can I ask you, when you talked to the sister of the one suspect, what did she want, and is she still supportive of everything you have done?
Yeah, it's a great question. She didn't want anything other than the truth. Although she didn't feel her brother was a violent person, and he really, there's nothing we found that showed him being violent. That doesn't mean that he wasn't there. And so all she asked for in return for her cooperation was that we keep her updated.
We're going to take a break from our sponsors, and we'll be back with more with Clint Cole.
If you ever have an accident, just where do you take your vehicle for top-notch repair? I could tell you, but isn't it better to hear from past Davis Body Shop customers? Here's what Kim M. from Atascadero had to say.
What an amazing team. I could not have asked for better service, and my car looked as good as new when they were finished. Patrick took care of me from day one, always keeping me updated about the process and their speedy timeline. I highly recommend them to all my friends and family. Excellent job.
Scott from Atascadero had this to say.
Great body shop. I was hit by another vehicle and took my truck to Davis. The work was done over a month ago and the repair work still looks great. No hidden problems. The truck left Davis in better condition than before the accident. Thanks to Tim and Patrick for all the extra work. It's really appreciated.
And that's why Davis Body Shop is the largest auto body collision specialist in San Luis Obispo County with two locations. On El Camino Real at Atascadero and on Theater Drive at Paso Chevrolet.
I recently had the best visit with Peter Lussier at Hearing Aid Specialists. He fixed my hearing aid, gave me an efficient hearing test, and adjusted my hearing aids using computer software. I've had my hearing aids for several years. I never felt they were working properly until Peter fixed the issues. The clarity and volume are wonderful now.
If you have hearing aids or need a hearing aid evaluation, call Hearing Aid Specialists of the Central Coast, 805-460-7385. 805-460-7385.
Adler Belmont Insurance Brokers welcomes Heather Bordan to its team of commercial property casualty professionals. With more than 20 years of experience, Heather can design insurance solutions that protect your business. Whether you're a contractor, winery owner, farmer, rancher, or manufacturer, Heather is the right person to survey your needs and develop innovative solutions to protect your most important asset. Contact Heather today, 805-540-3900, or Heather at AdlerBelmontGroup.com.
It's clearance time at Tackin Shoes, and the savings are huge. Tackin's has the best sheepskin slippers and boots from Bearpaw, Emu, and Superlam, now 20 to 50% off. 20 to 50% off fall and end-of-season casual shoes from favorites like Clarks, Atrex, Birkenstock, Born, Heen, and more. And, of course, work boots from Wolverine, Red Wing, Redback, Ariat, Workzone, and more. The January clearance sale at Tackin's, 8th and Spring in Paso, 668 Marsh and Slow, or online at 805boots.com.
Welcome back to Sound Off. My name is Karen Vealy. I'm your host on Wednesday and Thursday afternoons. I'm also an investigative reporter with Cal Coast News. Go to Cal Coast News. There is no paywall. And if you want to hear what happened at yesterday's meeting, so they have to do a Truth Act forum at the county once a year. And they don't usually do them because there's nothing to report. So generally, the Truth Act says that law enforcement cannot get involved with enforcing immigration. They weren't enforcing immigration. It's not their job. They're about the security and safety of the county. They are not tasked with enforcing immigration. They weren't doing it before the Truth Act. But with the Truth Act, it made more rules regarding handing people over to ICE. So if ICE makes a detainer and it's a minor crime like a DUI, they can't hand them over. If they burglarized a home or raped a woman or assaulted someone, they are required. They can harbor a fugitive. If they have warrants, they're required to hand them over. So it made it a little bit more difficult, but it doesn't say You're not allowed to hand someone over to ICE if they're an illegal immigrant. They're also not allowed to obstruct ICE. You know, Ian Parkinson spoke at the meeting. He made it very clear. We can't obstruct ICE. That's a felony. And we can't harbor a criminal. So if they know ICE is in the lobby, they can harbor somebody in there so ICE does not arrest them. They have to let them out. The meeting was very interesting. Bruce Gibson was trying to find ways that Parkinson could skirt that. What if we block everyone from ever entering? They want to have a doorman at the lobby of the jail that you have to have a reason other than your ICE and that you're going to visit someone. And without a reason, they won't let you into the jail lobby. And then all the fighting with the protesters would be out in the lobby. Ian's not allowing the protesters to call names, scream and yell, and blow whistles in the lobby. So the goal is, let's move it outside the lobby where they can have their interactions. That was one of the promotions. The other one was, if ICE is out in the lobby, why don't we stair-step it? We won't let them out. I think this gets very dangerous to violating federal laws. I don't know. It was very interesting. There was screaming, there was crying, there was arguing. Don Ortiz, like, I do believe she was very passionate. She cried repeatedly. It was an interesting show, which I call it a show because it started at 1:30 and went to almost 9 p.m. It was brutal. And Ian Parkinson sat through the entire thing. And I was told in other counties when this has happened, some of the sheriffs haven't even shown up. Others have shown up and left right after they gave their report. Ian and other sheriff department staffers sat there so they could explain throughout. But if you want to know what happened, I didn't really cover what the protesters said. A lot of it was gobbledygook. A lot of it was, there were people from other counties accusing Parkinson's of things they have no idea. Both Don Ortiz Legg and Jimmy Paulding, all the other supervisors except for Bruce Gibson, said they thought that Parkinson was doing the right thing. Bruce Gibson said, I think there's ways you could do a better job. And he had these ideas. In the end, they all wanted to throw money. There was an idea, let's give the nonprofits more money through the Community Foundation. And these are the nonprofits, you know, basically they train ICE protesters to follow law enforcement around. So if you get a chance, go read the article. I put it up this morning. I think it's a very interesting conundrum. And again, one of the things you need to know, they're not just following ICE. Like, for example, this morning, there were some ICE agents trying to have breakfast. They went to the Pismo Beach coffee shop to harass ICE, and they wanted people to show up and harass them. But also, when the sheriff department arrests people, there are times they say, get over there. Since they've gotten a whole lot of new volunteers because of the deaths in Minnesota, they're going after every time they see law enforcement going to do something, they're sending people out. And it can be very, I think somebody could get hurt. If there's a law enforcement and they're going to arrest a murderer and they're going in their plain clothes and they're going in the morning to go in quietly, and then you have 50 people surrounding them asking for warrants and blowing whistles to warn the person, and this happened with one murder suspect, you are putting law enforcement in our community in danger, I believe. Take a look at it. We'll be talking about this next Thursday with Greg Haskins. But today we are talking with Cold Case Sheriff County Sheriff's Department Detective Clint Cole. We are talking right now about one case. We're going to talk about multiple cases. One of the things, Clint, I want to ask you, how many of these people, I didn't even get to it. We have our top of the hour break. We will start back with talking about how many cold cases you have solved and going through the different cold cases and what you did. And again, I find your work very impressive. I believe this is something you were meant to do.
Thank you.
We'll be back after our top of the hour break.
AM 1230 KPRL, 99.3 FM, KPRL.com, Paso Robles, Atascadero, Templeton.
It's 1 o'clock.